Welcome back to the 443 Security Simplified. I'm your host, Mark LaLiberty, and with me today is...
The Knock Reiner.
The Knock Reiner. That's going to be his new WWE name, by the way. In today's episode, we are going to talk about our security report that was just released a few days ago, actually. Well, I guess by the time this is published a bit more than that. We'll dive through some of the insights, some of the data that we get from the report, and give you some good takeaways on how to keep your network safe from the bad guys. So with this episode, I guess we can talk about our freshly published internet security report.
Woo-hoo.
The work is done, the labor of love is finished, and now we have, 2 weeks off until we start the next one?
Our work's been done for a little while. It has to go through all the polish passes.
Yep. And it is now published as of midnight, Tuesday night? Something like that?
Beats the heck out of me.
On watchguard.com/security-report. And for this episode, I figure we can dive in and go over some of the highlights from the report and discuss some of the cool things we found. So I guess we can start with the stats first, because that's generally where we always start. Malware-wise, report after report, we always track volumes of malware detected by our fireboxes in something we call the firebox feed. The firebox feed is the threat intelligence we get back from fireboxes deployed by our customers throughout the world. And this quarter, the malware we detected was down from last quarter pretty substantially, right?
Yeah, quite a bit. 42%, if I remember right.
And that's even... that's 42% down for malware is pretty nuts, but network attacks were down even more.
Yeah. That was like
90%.
Crazy, 90%.
Which I think is the most.
And by the way, what's interesting is this is down from Q1, which has always historically been a down quarter. In our past report, I think even in our past podcast about it, we talk about how Q4 has always been the highest quarter for both malware and network attacks as far as volume, likely due to the retail sales seasons that go along with the holidays during that quarter. So we do expect Q1 to drop, and Q1 is always pretty low, so to be down from a low quarter is especially interesting. And traditionally Q2 has not gone down from Q1, it's gone up, so definitely a different trend this report.
I'm going to interpret this as good news though, because it means the hackers are giving up, right?
That must be it. Yeah. There's going to be no botnets. You can probably turn your fireboxes and the doorstops now.
Yep.
It's all going to be okay.
Uninstall
I'm
McAfee
sure
from your computer.
The U.S. president solved it.
No, it was his kid with the cybers experience, right?
Yes. He knew the cybers. Maybe he hired that 40-year-old fat man in the basement.
Don't talk about me like that.
400-pound fat man in the basement.
So we tracked the zero-day malware number quarter after quarter, too. That was down as well. Last quarter was actually pretty high. I think one of the highest ones we'd seen at 46%-ish. And this quarter,
47.
Yeah, this quarter is back down to like 37%.
Yeah,
which is
still big,
more than a third of all malware.
That's kind of a different trend too, since that's a ratio. It doesn't matter if malware volume's up or down. That's a ratio of what one type of solution, a signature based solution, catches versus another. So even if malware were high, if that goes down, it essentially just means malware is not evading signature based solutions as often. Not sure what to read into that. I think it will continue to stay in the above 35, but it just means that we saw less newish looking variants as often this quarter.
Man, this sure makes our job easy.
Yeah. Maybe they realize our security, our new intelligent AV is so good, they just have no chance.
There we go. They're just giving up. So outside of that, we saw the return of several threats that we see almost quarter after quarter now. Mimikatz actually made it all the way up to the number one threat. Mimikatz being a very popular password theft tool that we've talked about quite a few times on this podcast, I'm pretty sure.
Credential stealer. It's gone up a number of quarters before, but never to number one. So literally being the number one badware variant in our antivirus was quite new.
Yeah. We also saw three different Microsoft Office exploits or payloads that contained malicious Microsoft Office code. Two of them, or actually all of them, were exploits from 2017, so last year, relatively new compared to some of the other stuff we see. I mean, we see attacks from like 2010 showing up all over the place still.
On the IPS side of things, for sure.
Yeah, and so these were a memory corruption vulnerability, and then another just code execution vulnerability, one affecting rich text format RTF files. Interesting seeing those show up. I don't think those had been in there previously, at least not in the malware side.
We have different Office CVEs every quarter for the past three quarters. One of the consistent themes for a while has been Office documents are being used quite often for malicious purposes. But it seems like what exact variant of what CVE, what actual vulnerability they use changes slightly. To me, it's kind of interesting to know what exploit they're using, but I bet you these are all just baked into an exploit kit. Ultimately, the impact of one Office flaw versus another is, you know, yeah, sometimes there's subtle differences, but most of them are code execution type things where if you open something, executes code. So it doesn't matter too much to me what CVE it is, other than most of them are old. If you patched, you shouldn't have to worry about any of this stuff.
Either way, it shows that Office documents are still very popular for attackers as a way to try and get malware onto your systems, because it's much easier to trick a user into opening up a Word doc than it is to open an executable these days, luckily.
Yeah, if you have a training or awareness program out there wherever you work, I think talking about Office documents is big. You know, 20 years ago, we still had to convince people not to run executables in an email. But I think nowadays, everybody in the world, including my great-grandma in Kansas, knows not to touch executable
files. Should we test that?
That would be a fun project. But an Office document, you know, a document in a PDF, I mean, I think every security researcher knows that they can be hijacked and booby-trapped. But I bet you some users still kind of consider them benign. They might understand the macro side of things, so they might avoid Office documents when they ask to run macros, but they may not realize the exploit side of things. So might be a good thing to add to your training and awareness programs.
Yes, definitely. Also in the malware space, cryptocurrency miners were continuing to rise. So last quarter, we saw one of our generic just dropper signatures, actually 98.8% of all of its detections were a cryptocurrency mining piece of malware. This quarter, we actually had a straight up crypto miner in the top 10 list. This one was a JavaScript-based Monero miner. It's matches signatures for CoinHive, or at least CoinHive clones. CoinHive was actually developed originally as a, I'm using air quotes here, legitimate piece of JavaScript that you could run on your website as a additional revenue stream, where when visitors show up to your website, it steals a little bit of their processing power to solve the complex math equations that are required for mining cryptocurrency, and you scrape a little bit of money off the top there. And it kind of makes sense as evolution of people starting to block advertisements, where some websites are starting to have to look to other revenue streams, but
sure,
it seemed a little excessive for me.
To know whether it's being used legit. Like, it's hard to know if it's the site owner that's doing it or if it's an injection attack where it's a site that's not doing, you know, not purposely doing this to their visitors.
Yep.
So,
and unfortunately, it was a really good idea that attackers have taken over now, and they are using it to using cross-site scripting vulnerabilities to host their own CoinHive scripts to siphon off people's computer resources.
Yep.
Some of the trends that we saw with it, if you, for some reason, don't have pop-ups disabled in your browser, a lot of these samples will use pop-unders to try and hide the window that's running the JavaScript. Because with JavaScript, once you close the browser window, it's done. So if they can keep that miner running in the background without you knowing, they earn more money. And that's one of the ways that they try and hide it. I've seen a few examples where they actually do the pop under underneath your taskbar in Windows, which makes it even more difficult to find, especially if you're someone like me that just constantly has Chrome open with 50,000 tabs. You're not going to notice that there's one tab hidden somewhere down below.
Yeah. Although granted, these are all the same tricks they've used for any malicious, you know, web content that they have running in the background, whether it be a man in the browser attack or whatever. So
it just shows that old attacks are still at least relevant.
Used for new purposes.
Exactly.
Now, what would be interesting, though, is when we first talked about, I mean, we've been talking about cryptocurrency forever, but when we first talked about these attacks increasing over the last, you know, a year to half a year, it was because cryptocurrency was skyrocketing. Mm-hmm. I think Bitcoin at one point was
20,000 bucks.
And I think it's, you know, just barely 6.5 are under 6.5 now. So it'd be interesting to see if the focus, for a while there, crypto miners seem to be going higher than ransomware. It'd be interesting to see if this attack or this trend continues, or if they'll level out and maybe disappear until cryptocurrency recovers some of its value.
It is for sure something to watch out for, because who knows? I don't think cryptocurrency as a whole is going to just evaporate tomorrow.
Cryptocurrency won't go away. So maybe the value has stabilized a little to more reasonable places.
Well, you don't think a Bitcoin's worth $20,000?
I never did, my friend. Never did.
That was one of the biggest problems with it when it hit that value was there's other things that go on in terms of using Bitcoin. You have to pay a transaction fee in order to actually announce a transaction on the network. And once it hit $20,000, the transaction fee for a single transaction hit well over $15, almost 30 bucks in some cases. Which, when you're trying to buy a pizza or a piece of malware off the dark web,
it's a worthless currency.
Yeah, it's
at that transaction fee.
Yes.
Plus the fact that it's Bitcoin specifically has always had slow transactions. Granted, there's methods they use to try to speed them up, but as it goes to 20,000 and more people start adopting it, the transaction speed becomes even more critical.
It was like hours at one point in time. Yeah. But I mean, like you said, it's starting to stabilize. And I think, unfortunately, the bad guys have noticed that crypto miners are a decent way to earn a revenue stream. So they're probably sticking around at least for a bit. In terms of geographic distribution for malware, United States was last.
Yeah, and that is very unusual. I guess it's the second time it's happened, but usually APAC, not only is United States not last, but APAC is significantly less percentages compared to it. And not only has APAC now taken the second spot, but it's not by a small percentage.
Yeah, and this is literally the only second time we've seen APAC in a quarter be not dead last place, with last quarter being the first time. And I think they were even the most in terms of malware volume last quarter.
One of the interesting things, and I think it was a trend that's happened twice specifically with malware, is there's one specific threat on the top 10 anyways that's really putting APAC on the map. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of our generic signature called Win32 here. It's a signature to catch Windows malware. That's what the Win32 is. And the here is it's a heuristic signature. It looks for suspicious indicators in the executable file.
Say that again faster.
Yeah, maybe or should I say anomalous or suspicious factors in it. Sorry.
You smell burnt toast.
Is there a theme to my jokes lately? Anyways, it looks for suspicious factors in executable files. But anyways, the main reason I bring it up, that signature can catch all kinds of different malware, which is why we can't really specifically say what it is. But I think the hits for that signature have been majority India. And yes, India is part of the Asian Pacific, by the way. So that is really those Indian Win32 hits are the ones that are driving this percentage up for APAC.
Yeah. Outside of that, crypto miners were primarily targeting the United States. Same with Mimikatz, which we've seen Mimikatz quarter after quarter targeting primarily the United States.
I'm kind of surprised about crypto miners. Yeah. Like Mimikatz, we don't know for sure, but languages that use non-standard ASCII characters, I believe hashes are hashes, but they might be a little harder for attackers to interpret. So maybe there's a reason for Mimikatz, but I don't really care where a computer in the world I'm victimizing is if it has resource, because it's going to make me cryptocurrency. I don't know why you'd limit that to the U.S.
Yeah, that is really interesting. The Office exploits we mentioned earlier, 3/4 of them actually targeted EMEA, so Europe. Another interesting stat out of that.
Kind of different, too, because in the past, some of the malicious Word documents we saw were affecting U.S.
Yeah, I think Great Britain showed up every once in a while,
times,
but it was primarily the States. So interesting following that, too. In terms of network attacks, not a whole lot new this last quarter. A lot of the favorites returned yet again. I think we had just 2 signatures that showed up as brand new.
Yep. On the top 10, you mean?
On the top 10, yes. No, in total. We only had 2 new pieces of 2 new attacks in the whole quarter.
I will say, we'll talk about the 2 new attacks, but one of the things, if you read our report, you'll see is we're not limiting our analysis to the top 10 anymore. We're still talking about the top 10, But if all of the top 10 or the majority of it is attacks we've seen before, we're not going to waste our audience's time recapping them. And rather, we'll dig deeper into the top 25 or find an interesting piece of malware that's trending or growing faster than normal, or network attack, and talk about that too, which we did in this particular report.
Yep. In terms of the two new ones, though, there was a PHP-based vulnerability, I suppose, in the way that it handles zip archives. That could cause PHP applications to crash. It was interesting seeing that one in the top 10 because it, I don't know, it seems kind of niche.
By the way, to me, I had a little discussion with one of our researchers who wrote this section, but I believe the Integer Overflow also allowed code execution too,
okay.
Even though we mentioned it as a DOS in the report.
And outside that, we also had a Shockwave player vulnerability, and their PAMI chunk parsing, so pattern analysis and machine intelligence parsing, which could cause an improperly formatted video to make the entire Shockwave thing crash, or I assume get code execution too. And that one was from 2010, if I remember right, which is a fairly old flaw.
Pretty old.
But again, that's not exactly surprising. We see a lot of really old stuff in the network attacks.
If you've ever downloaded an exploit kit like the Nuclear Pack or those type of kits, they come with a list of known Adobe Internet Explorer flaws, and they range from old as dirt to maybe only a year old. In fact, some of them you can even add subscription services if you really want the modern month-by-month 0 day.
It's like a loot crate for exploits.
There you go. Subscribe.
It just shows that, I mean, attackers are going to continue trying to exploit old attacks because they...
Why not?
They work. People still don't update their browsers, and it just... You need to make sure that you maintain security patches on everything you expose to the internet.
Think about the SMB flaw in Conficker. Like, mm-hmm. I believe that was a MS-08, so 2008 flaw. And like 9 years after, it was still the worm capabilities of Conficker were still working in networks that hadn't patched that 2008. So it seems silly to us because we say patch pretty much every single day, let alone month. A lot of smart IT, like our department, definitely has turned into a cyclical patch cycle where they follow the advice. But I think there's a big majority of people that don't. And then there's always that one, is it politically incorrect to say redheaded stepchild server? Sorry, my wife's a redhead. I'll say that one old server sitting around somewhere that because of some weird custom code or some reason you need that one 2003 version of Windows that just remains a threat unless you really air gap it.
Actually, I just got back from the Arizona Technology Summit about an hour and a half ago. I got off the plane, and while I was there, I spoke to quite a few of the attendees, and one of them actually brought up after my talk that they were the victim of a ransomware attack, and they didn't notice it until one of their services broke, and when they went into their LAN room, they found that they had an old server that they had entirely forgotten about that was actually mission critical, but was running on a unpatched Microsoft Server 2003.
I remember a story. I wish I looked up the publication where I read it, and I don't. It could be one of those internet mother's tales, but it was some company that put up this FTP server in the 2000s, the aughts, and it was in some little utility closet. And then they redesigned their office space, and suddenly they walled up. And so inside one of their walls, they found this old FTP server still available with the FTP port on the internet, hadn't been patched in years and years. I don't know if that's true. That seems too crazy to be true, but I read it somewhere. And the internet's always true, right?
Yeah, no, you can't lie on the internet.
I didn't think so.
No. That's insane. But I can't imagine the guy I talked to is the only person that has a server they've forgotten about.
I think
somewhere.
One of the favorite things at tech conferences is talking about how often you see XP in the wild nowadays. And surprisingly, XP is still pretty relevant in the wild.
Yeah. I mean, in some cases, there is... Actually, I don't like validating their excuse. But in some cases, there is specialized software that It was very expensive to develop.
But to me, the problem there isn't the person keeping it because of their excuse. It's the dumb vendor of the specialized software.
Yes.
What is their excuse? Money. They're the one that's messing up SCADA environments and everyone else by not keeping current with modern operating systems.
I wonder in those cases how many of those vendors are actually still in business. And maybe it's just...
That's a good point.
They literally don't exist.
Then it might be the person's fault for not finding a replacement.
So takeaway from that, go take a flashlight through your LAN room and check every server and make sure you don't have a 2003 server hidden in the wall.
Maybe you need an X-ray machine to check your walls.
Do they make like stud finders for servers?
There you go.
I wonder what would happen if we took a metal detector in.
Maybe we shouldn't put that in the podcast. We got a business opportunity, guy. We'll kickstart it.
Yeah, all right. We'll cut that one out. No one heard that. So past the network attacks and the malware trends, we always try and dive into some major newsworthy security event, sometimes a few. In this last quarter, we talked about eFail.
Yeah, I always love it when they have marketing names. That's so great. It makes the vulnerability so much better.
Man, I should have gotten acceptable use for their banner to stick it in there too.
And you know, when they have marketing names, they must be pretty serious and not overstated at all.
Oh.
Speaking of, tell me about eFail, Mark.
Let's talk about eFail.
Transition.
So eFail, the latest in the marketed vulnerabilities. I guess let's back up and first talk about email encryption. we'll give it some context before we just crap all over their marketed vulnerability.
Email encryption is a simple topic. Everyone understands it. We don't have to cover it.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Like public private keys and fingerprints and PGP, simple stuff everyone uses, right?
Yeah, it's even more than that. Like total email privacy is actually a pretty big concern for some individuals. Like if you're a journalist embedded in like Russia reporting on Russian stuff, you want to make sure you remain anonymous as you submit your stories to fake news New York Times, right?
Yeah.
Or maybe if you're just a company with very sensitive information as you email it around. And one way to do email
encryption...
Frankly,
if you're any company and you have any intellectual, you really should be considering email security more than many people do.
Yes. And one of the easiest things people end up doing is just emailing TLS encryption on their mail servers. And unfortunately, some people think that that's just enough for keeping their email secure. But the problem with TLS encryption on the mail server...
the entire chain.
Exactly. Your email will bounce over several different servers from when you send it on your client to when the recipient actually receives it in their inbox. And you have no control over encryption on all of those little hops.
Yeah, you only know that your server sending it to the first hop is good, but from that point on, you don't know.
Yep, and it means if one of those servers is owned by a bad guy or the NSA, who may be bad guys depending on your views, they can get a copy of that email, and if it's unencrypted, they have full access to it. So in comes PGP and SMIME. So PGP, pretty good privacy. SMIME, secure multi-purpose internet mail extensions. And they're basically two different ways to encrypt the message itself so that no matter what happens on the hops from your computer to the recipient, if someone gets a hold of the message, the contents are still encrypted. It's not relying on the communication channel, it's the message itself. Both of them use public key encryption, actually quite similar to HTTPS. SMIME is probably the most similar in that it uses a chain of trust or certificates, as we call them, where if you trust whatever certificate authority issued the cert that signed your email, then you trust that email message and you're able to validate and then decrypt it. PGP is a little different. It uses something called a web of trust, where it doesn't use certificates. You have to find some way to share your key, your public key, with the recipient before you send a message. And there's places you can do that. We use MIT's PGP server. There's quite a few other ones you can use as well. It's just ways to pre-distribute your key before sending a sensitive email.
By the way, a little pro tip, one thing that almost no one does with PGP, the reason we call this a web of trust is it's really up to you to validate that key. And you know, to be honest, if I say I'm Mark and I put my key on MIT and it happens to have an email address that you associate with Mark, you have no clue if that's really Mark's key. But one thing PGP does have built in is a fingerprint. Mm-hmm. One thing you're supposed to do every time you start a new communication, every time you start the first contact with some new person with PGP is after you get their key, wherever they say to go to get it, you should contact them through a side channel, not email, which is why no one does it, call them up, and there's a fingerprint that you should be reading off their public key to make sure it really is their public key. Wanted to point that out for the true security nerds. That's how you can make this kind of web of trust thing really secure. But technically, if you're not confirming that fingerprint through a side channel, you're blindly trusting some random key.
Exactly. So the bottom line is with SMIME or PGP, though, if someone gets a hold of the encrypted message, it is still encrypted. They can't read whatever you're sending along with it. And this is where eFail comes in, where eFail actually gives an attacker a chance to force the recipient to automatically, in some cases, decrypt the message and send the contents of it back to the attacker. eFail actually encompasses two different vulnerabilities. The first one abuses how some mail clients actually handle mixed content messages. So mixed content being an email message with both encrypted and unencrypted contents. Some mail clients...
Or, by the way, mixed content's also used for like a text email message that has
some
a binary
HTML.
File attached.
Yeah.
The binary file is a different MIME content that has to be inserted too. So.
Yep. And some mail clients actually block by default mixed content messages when it comes to PGP or SMIME encrypted, but not all of them do. And those ones that don't, most of them ran into this kind of issue where an attacker can actually generate an email that has carefully crafted HTML elements where they paste the encrypted message into, say, the source for an image HTML element. So when the web client receives the message, it decrypts the encrypted message. And now that decrypted content, is part of the source for an image. So when the mail client goes to load that image, it sends a request out to the web server, probably owned by the attacker, and the path in that web server request is the decrypted message. It's actually, like, once you see it, this vulnerability, it's like, oh, well, duh, yeah, of course that's a problem. And it required a few different factors to actually be carried out correctly. A, the mail client has to load external content, which by default, most of them don't. You often have the option to enable it, though, per email, per recipient, whatever. And also, it needs to decrypt mixed content messages automatically.
And by the way, do you think this one in particular is really a vulnerability in either PGP or SMIME, or more in how email clients are handling
this
mixed
one
content?
And I think it was even framed in a way that it's more on how email clients handle it as opposed to the protocol itself.
Yep.
Because the second vulnerability is actually a issue with the encryption modes that PGP and SMIME use when it comes to encrypting and decrypting a message. Because there are block ciphers, CBC for SMIME and CFB for PGP, if an attacker knows the exact plain text content of a encrypted block, they can modify the ciphertext in order to modify the plain text that's inside of it. So even without decrypting and re-encrypting, they can change the contents of an encrypted block if they knew exactly what it was before it was encrypted. So when it comes to SMIME, most emails that are encrypted with SMIME start with a very specific header, content type, multi-part signed. And so because you know a block that contains
one
that
specific thing,
you have the opportunity to modify it and, say, inject a image tag and a source that'll force the mail client to go send out a request once it decrypts the message. PGP was actually, they noted it was a bit more difficult to exploit in this case, A, because it compresses messages before it encrypts them, so it makes it a little more difficult to find where that plain text is.
They don't know exactly where that particular,
Yep, and most PGP clients actually have integrity checking in the form of something called a modification detection code.
Just what we need, more acronyms.
Exactly.
MDC.
MDC, yes. So if your PGP has MDC with the CBC, you're probably safe. My track.
Good job saying CBC instead of something like, I don't know, CBD.
My track drops next week, by the way. So either way, one of my issues with eFail, aside from it being heavily marketed, is that some of the first reactions to it were, oh, disable PGP on all of your mail clients immediately. Don't use it at all.
And SMIME. These are broken email encryption algorithms. So you're screwed. We have no way to secure it anymore.
Exactly. And I think that was way overkill. It was a few clients had issues in very specific circumstances that could cause information leakage. That doesn't mean you stop using the protocols entirely everywhere. And if I'm going to go out on my my tangent here. I think this is actually a pretty big issue in the security industry as a whole, where we often, I've done it too. We react to vulnerabilities with the worst possible case scenario and go based off that instead of a practical one. Yeah, FUD, exactly. Instead
fear,
of going
uncertainty,
after
and doubt, for those that may not know the acronym.
FUD, yes. Instead of going after whatever the most common issues are, or especially for your own threat model, we tend to just go off and say, oh, it's awful, disable it entirely. So that was my issue with this. Either way, still interesting vulnerabilities. It was really a huge, moment when I read that first one. Because
yeah, but these
sense.
Are, to me, the big thing with this, I do think they were a little, had too much hyperbole when they first announced this. Mm-hmm. But they're still decent issues. But in either case, saying that you can't use it anymore is silly. Both of these things are easily fixed. And one is more a client problem than a standard problem. So,
yeah.
I mean, and both had workarounds, as you
literally
said.
Literally a checkbox in
if
most
you were
clients.
Using MDC, you were fine. Or,
MDC
for
with
the
your
PGP
CBC
one.
In the PGP?
PGP, and then it wouldn't be FUD.
But PGP is CFB. Do you hear me?
I guess it depends on if you're using SMIME or PGP. Pick your block cipher.
That was definitely something interesting to dig into. Our last bit for the report, we always try to include some of our own research. And this one, we actually had our two newest junior analysts go through and perform some research for this report. Yep. And it came in the form of a password analysis of the LinkedIn data breach from a few years back, where they got a hold
of all... Kind of an older breach, but yeah. They thought that they had a little different take on something they didn't see. I mean, most people will take these password leaks, which, by the way, usually come in the form of hashes that mm-hmm. you have to crack. And they, of course, will spend time cracking them, but then they'll just report on very generic passwords used type stuff.
Yeah. And so in this case, they got all 117 million credential pairs, and then they... first split them up by, so because they had email addresses associated with them, we could try and pair off where they might be associated with. And so they pulled out all of the government and military email addresses and looked at those specifically, which is interesting.
And to what I said, that was essentially our new twist on it, is let's take a specific look at certain types of addresses like government and military compared to others.
So long story short, we were able to crack 50% of the passwords in under a week for
government and military.
Yeah.
By the way, they were only a fraction. I mean, I think combined it was around 1 million different emails. So numbers-wise, quite a few government and military accounts, but it was only a fraction of the overall population.
At least in the breach database.
Of the breach database. Yep. And if you think about, like, I forget what the number is, but we looked up on average, like about 17% of the U.S. population is government or military, but the percentage of representation in this database was much lower than even normal civilian to standard person.
Yep. My interesting takeaway from this, though, was that even government employment doesn't necessarily translate to better password practices.
Nope. Ultimately, like you said, we cracked 50%, but the main takeaway was of the 50% we cracked, we can kind of compare the strength of a password of them versus the quote-unquote civilian passwords we cracked. And government and military were 2% better at making stronger passwords, but only 2%. So not really as big as it should be.
You'd think with all the acronyms that they have to go along with in terms of best practices from NIST and stuff, by being employees, they might have a little bit of practices even on their own personal accounts, but it seems like they are just like every single other person in the world in terms of password strength.
Yep.
And it just shows that multi-factor authentication can be very important here when it comes to protecting these weak passwords.
Absolutely.
That way, even if someone is able to crack your password in under a week, if you have that second factor, you're still at least in a better off spot than you would be. So that was it for our report. Anything else you wanted to add?
Not really.
All
we
right.
should probably talk about what people should do.
Yeah. So because malware and network attacks are down, you can probably unplug all of your network security equipment.
Yeah. And throw it away, turn off the antivirus.
Yeah. Speed up your computer.
By the way, a benefit of our network antivirus is you don't have to slow down your computer.
How about some real takeaways, though? You go first.
Well, I think you just mentioned one of them. I mean, a theme, if we go over all themes, one of the big themes in this report was authentication weaknesses. Mm-hmm. We saw Memcats hit number one. One of the things we didn't talk about because it was an old network attack, but we also saw brute force logins. This was a type of network attack that if you have any sort of public website that has a login, they'll try to brute force it if you haven't throttled it. We saw those attacks, which have shown up on our top 10 before, move up a couple slots and become more popular. And then, of course, we looked into how good people are with passwords. And overall, you know, bad guys are targeting authentication. If I'm a cyber criminal, why would I try to figure out some zero-day vulnerability to hack the Democratic National Committee when I can probably fish some dude there, get a privileged password, and then log in as a totally authorized person that gets past all the security controls? So multi-factor, to me, you know, there's a number of password tips and authentication tips we put in the report. But to me, the main one is multi-factor. Passwords are never going to be perfect. Biometrics are easy to use and are good, but you know, a persistent, sophisticated attacker could probably bypass a biometric token. But the more factors you have together, the harder it is for them to bypass multiple things.
Yep. And I guess another takeaway, you probably don't need to take a sledgehammer to your network room walls, but maybe take a look at all these systems that you have online and make sure that you have a patching plan in place for all of them to keep them updated with whatever security updates have come out.
By the way, hopefully a lot of you out there are doing vulnerability assessment scans or at the very least regular net Nmap scans. One thing that I think a lot of administrators find is that their users often plug things in they don't know about. So, you know, one thing you can simply do is run an Nmap scan on all your internal networks, or even if you haven't paid for a vulnerability scanner, there's things like OpenVAS, which are freely available, that are essentially an Nmap scan, plus it will tell you patch levels for available services. So it'll help you find that hidden FTP server in your wall, and it will even help you figure out what you have to patch and what you don't. So do that regularly.
It may not help you find the server. It'll at least let you know it's there.
Sure, it's there.
You'll still need the patented Mark and Corey server stud finder in order to get it out of the wall.
Trademarked.
Trademarked.
Copyright. 20,000. Oh, I can't say dates. 20,000. When did that come? 2018?
How old are you? What year is it? Also, keep an eye out for Office documents still. They're not going anywhere. I mean, Office documents have been a delivery mechanism for malware for decades now, and they're continuing to work, and so they're continuing to stay around. Yeah. So just because it's not an executable attached to your email doesn't mean it's safe. Always treat everything suspect that you receive from unsolicited sources.
And if we add another, I mean, one thing you should turn on automatic patching for, you know, we talk about patching a lot as a security thing, and maybe one day we should have a discussion about whether or not to patch automatically, because sometimes for production servers, you may want to test before deploying patches, but for a, you know, kind of an end user product like Office, where it's not going to kill the operating system to patch Office. It's, in your worst case.
You say that.
It has not happened in a long time that an Office patch has borked a Windows system. Knock on wood. But if you turn on fully automatic patches for anything, Office might be a good choice, because every single one of these Office threats we've seen, at least the exploit ones, have not been zero day. They've been fixed.
And correct me if I'm wrong, Microsoft is actually really pushing towards that in at least their consumer versions of Office and Windows, of forcibly enabling patching. Whether you like it or not.
Yeah. And it's still my tip for, even if you're an organization, I say for your client Windows systems, turn it on. There have been, you know, I say that knowing that the amount of blue screens from Microsoft patches has gone down significantly since a decade ago, but they still happen. Mm-hmm. I remember doing a video recommending that, and then like a month later, there was a patch that had to be revoked.
Egg on your face.
Yeah, but if it's just a single user's laptop, it's not as big a risk. It's only the production servers that I warn that you might want to do the testing before deploying.
Yep. So definitely something to pay attention to. Anything else you want to add? before we wrap it up?
I don't think so. I'm sure we could add more. Go read the report. There's a few more tips there, including layering on malware with our new intelligent AV. But for time's sake, I say we call it a day.
Yep. So watchguard.com/security-report. And again, you can get access to a lot of the same data that we use at our threat landscape page at secplicity.org/threat-landscape. Where if you want to build your own little mini report out of the data, you can check it out there. But then you miss the colorful commentary of Mark Coriandeau. Exactly.
But you can probably predict our top 10 for next quarter if you go there and put a filter on for, what is it, July to September now?
Something like that, yeah.
June, I think, maybe June 1st.
Months don't even matter to me right now. I need a coffee. Thanks again for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed the episode, please don't forget to rate, subscribe, and review us. You can check out your daily security insights at secplicity.org or find the security report that we just discussed at watchguard.com/security-report. You can find me on Twitter at @XORRO_ or Corey @SecAdept. Please feel free to tweet at us or the hashtag #the443podcast if you have any recommendations for future episode topics or even just any questions. Thanks again for listening, and we will see you next week.
To preempt those questions, the meaning of life is 47.
It's 42.
Oh, fart. Well, thanks for all the fish, Mark.